Thank you very much, Michael, and thank you to the Financial Review and Deloitte for hosting the event. And you've certainly set out a very ambitious agenda, and I look forward to reading the results of the discussion. The conference comes at an opportune time. There's the odd thing to talk about in financial services. For example, global financial markets are still in the grip of a pervasive search for yield that shows no sign of easing up. Major regulatory reform proposals are still being designed and implemented at the global level. Meanwhile, technological change is continuing to offer new opportunities for businesses to serve customers, but of course also disrupting the established ways of doing things. And not least, the Financial System Inquiry released its final report last year. You've got an extensive list of speakers over the next couple of days, and no doubt all of that territory and more will be covered. So my remarks are going to be, as usual, fairly general, and I should be clear that I have no comments to offer today on monetary policy. No doubt you'll all find some buried in there somewhere, but I don't have any offering on that. So I'd like to begin with a few remarks about the Financial System Inquiry. And of course, the chairman speaking immediately after me, so it wouldn't be appropriate for me to offer a chapter and verse on every detail of the very extensive recommendations that the committee brought down. But what I would like to do is make a couple of high-level observations on two or three themes. The first thing to say is that the bank welcomes the inquiry's report. The inquiry had a distinguished committee. It had a very capable secretariat and an effective and robust process of engagement. And we found our own engagement with the committee very constructive. The report is comprehensive, and it demonstrates, I think, the inquiry grappling with the big issues of the day. I hope the chairman won't mind me saying that all inquiries inevitably are shaped, to some extent at least, by their environment that they face. If you think back to the Campbell inquiry, well, it came at a time when informed opinion had already shifted quite a long way in the direction of favouring financial liberalisation. After a long period of experience with a highly regulated system, the limitations of that by the mid-1970s were increasingly apparent. And so the push was towards a financial system where market forces dictated more of the terms of engagement rather than the central bank or the government. That deregulatory mindset helped to prepare the ground for two of the most significant and beneficial changes in our financial system in modern times, and I refer to the float of the exchange rate and the removal of constraints on competition in the banking system. By the time Wallace came along in the mid-90s, the financial system had undergone significant change. We'd had liberalisation. There'd been an influx of new banks. There'd been a sharp run-up in credit, a boom and bust in asset prices, a painful recession in the early 1990s. So those things reinforced the importance of capital adequacy and of effective supervision. At the same time, by the mid-90s, developments in technology were much more in frame, and the anticipated growth of capital markets loomed large, and so those things shaped the Wallace Inquiry. The importance of payment systems was also much more on the radar screen by that time. As you know, and as Michael said, the Wallace recommendations transformed the regulatory architecture. APRA was created, and it took charge of bank supervision and the supervision of a number of other entities. A payment system board was created in the Reserve Bank with a mandate for efficiency and competition in the payment system and a mandate to control risk and contribute to financial stability. We had ASIC created out of predecessor institutions and given a stronger consumer protection mandate. That regulatory architecture continues today. There isn't really serious discussion about changing it in a fundamental way. And indeed, has been noted before, the regulatory setup and the system more generally came through the most severe international financial crisis since the Great Depression very well. Not unscathed, not without some missteps, not without some liquidity pressures or credit losses, and not without some important supportive policy actions. But overall, when the crisis narrative is told, we in Australia can certainly hold our heads up. But at the same time, there are critical learnings for Australia from the experiences of those who had a harder time of it than we did over the past 7 years. Yes, we survived the crisis pretty well, but how do we avoid that leading us into complacency? What do we have to do to protect against future crises? How should we respond to the wave of regulatory changes that's unfolding across the world? They're important questions. Meanwhile, technology continues to move ahead quickly, even if it's in ways that Wallace couldn't have foreseen. And Australia's privately funded retirement income system, which at the time of Wallace was growing, but by now has reached the equivalent of 100% of annual GDP, well, you can't omit that from any comprehensive review of the financial system. So that was the backdrop when the Murray Committee set to work. The inquiry has eschewed wholesale changes in favour of more incremental ones. Now, I don't want to offer a point-by-point response to all the recommendations. I just want to touch on three themes. The first is enhancing the banking system's resilience. There are a few issues here, but the most contentious one is whether banks' capital ratios, which have already risen since the crisis, should in fact rise a bit further. The inquiry concluded that they should. Now, there's been a lot of debate about just where the current capital ratios for our banks stand in the international rankings. And the reason there is so much debate is that this is a calculation that's very hard to do. There seems little doubt, though, that most supervisory authorities, and for that matter, most banks around the world, have since the crisis revised their thinking about how much capital is needed. And none of those revisions have been downwards. So wherever we stood in those rankings at a point in time, just to hold that place requires more capital in the future. And it's likely to be demanded by the market. There's generally not much doubt here about the way the world is moving. Of course, capital isn't costless. If capital requirements were to become too onerous, then the higher cost of borrowing could impinge on economic growth. But more capital also brings the benefit of a more resilient system, one less prone to crisis and better able to recover if a crisis does occur. Crises are infrequent, but they're very costly. So there's a cost-benefit calculation to be done here, a trade-off to be struck. Higher cost intermediation, maybe, a small negative increment to growth on average in normal times, in return for the reduced probability and reduced impact of deep downturns associated with financial crises. And the inquiry has thought about this issue in a cost-benefit framework. And weighing those costs and benefits, they've concluded that the benefits of moving further in the direction of resilience outweigh the rather small estimated costs. The second set of issues surrounds too big to fail institutions and their resolution. And I think the inquiry is to be commended for grappling with this very, very difficult issue. It's complex. And even after substantial regulatory reform at the global level, it's still a work in progress. The stated aim of all this work is to get to a situation where, with the right tools and preparation, It would be possible to resolve a failing bank or non-bank of systemic importance without disrupting the provision of its critical services and without balance sheet support from the public purse. This work is explicitly in an international setting for globally systemic entities, but the inquiry has quite sensibly seen the parallel for entities that are systemic domestically. Well, it needs to be said that ending too big to fail is an ambitious and very demanding objective. To achieve it, not only must systemic institutions hold more equity capital, but more tools to absorb losses are needed in the event that the equity is depleted. Typically envisaged in the international discussion is a bail-in, so-called, of some kind, in which a wider group of creditors would effectively become equity holders and who would share in the losses sustained by a failing entity. Of course, for that to work, there needs to be a market for the relevant securities, and that market needs to be genuinely independent of the deposit-taking sector. We can't, for example, have banks buying each other's bail-in obligations. In a resolution, should there be one, a host of operational complexities would have to be sorted out, and we shouldn't underestimate how complex they are. A resolution would need the support of foreign regulators if it's to be recognised across borders, and that's a whole host of additional complexity in itself. It would need a temporary stay on derivatives contracts so counterparties don't scramble for the collateral at the onset of resolution. And it would need to be structured and governed well enough to withstand the inevitable potential legal challenges and sustain market confidence. So that's a tall order. A proposal for so-called total loss absorbing capacity, or TLAC, was announced at the G20 summit in Brisbane last year. At the moment, consultations, quantitative impact assessments, and so on are underway, and an international standard will, we hope, be agreed by the G20 summit in Turkey later this year. Now, it's fair to say that in its main submission to the inquiry, the Reserve Bank counselled caution as far as bail-in is concerned, and we would still counsel caution here. The fact is this hasn't been done on a large scale very often, if at all, so far. The inquiry in its report also favours a cautious approach. But here again, the world seems to be moving in this general direction, thinking about how you resolve a potentially failing systemic entity and how you do that without just pumping in public funds. So it isn't really going to be credible or prudent for Australia, with some large institutions that we can all see are locally systemic, not to keep working on and thinking about improvements to resolution arrangements. The third set of recommendations from the inquiry that I want to touch on are those related to the payment system. Now, my take on the inquiry's report is that it's generally supported the steps that the Payment System Board has taken since its inception, but it's raised a few areas where the Board can consider some further steps. And as it happens, these dovetail pretty well with things that we've already been thinking about while the inquiry's been underway. The Reserve Bank has, since the inquiry's report was handed down, announced a review of card payments regulation, and we released an issues paper in March. Among other things, that contemplates the potential for changes to the regulation surrounding card surcharges and interchange fees. Now, surcharging tends to be a hot button issue with consumers. It generated a large number of submissions to the inquiry. Most of those submissions were in fact more or less identical, so it was a well-organised campaign. But nonetheless, that that indicates a degree of public concern. Most of that concern is directed at a couple of industries where surcharging is very prominent and where it appears to be at a rate that's well in excess of what you could reasonably conceive of as the cost of acceptance. Now, I should be clear that the Reserve Bank considers that the decision to allow surcharging in 2002 has been a valuable reform. It does allow merchants to signal to consumers that there are differences in the cost of acceptance of various payments mechanisms, and it's important that consumers face those costs. By helping to hold down the cost of payments to merchants, the right to surcharge arguably can help to hold down the prices of goods and services more generally. And in addition to that, when I use my Platinum Amex card and get points, somebody's paying for that through the prices of goods and services generally. It doesn't just come from nowhere. So there's an equity consideration as well. The bank made some incremental changes to the regulation of surcharging in 2013, but to date, they've had a limited effect on the cases of surcharging that most people regard as egregious. So our current review will consider ways that we could retain the benefits of surcharging but address the concerns about excessive surcharges. One way of doing this that the inquiry itself proposed was to prevent surcharging for some low-cost payment mechanisms, like maybe debit cards. That would give consumers access to a no-surcharge payment mechanism, including online. There are other options that might be considered, but these will all be on the table as we consult on these questions in the period ahead. Turning then to interchange fees, the capping of interchange fees is a long-standing policy, and we think a beneficial one. It is important, though, to ensure that it continues to meet its objectives. The caps were put in place in 2003 based on concerns that interchange fees in mature payment systems can distort choices, and perversely, they get driven higher. The process of competition actually pushes up this particular price. As suggested by the inquiry, the bank's review will consider whether the levels of the current caps remain appropriate. We don't prejudge this, but we do note, for example, that lower caps are now in place in some other jurisdictions. There are other elements of the current regime that warrant consideration too. While average interchange fees, roughly speaking, meet the regulated caps, the dispersion around the average has increased a lot over time. The practical effect of that is that there can be a difference of up to 180 basis points in the cost of the same card presented at different merchants. The fact that the merchant doesn't have visibility over those differences is, in our view, a problem, because it means that they can't really tell which cards are the high-cost ones and which are not. Now, this spread of interchange fees is not unique to Australia, but we do want to make sure, so far as we can, that the regulatory framework doesn't contribute to this trend or to the declining transparency of individual card costs to merchants. The bank's review will consider a range of options, including hard caps on interchange fees, hybrid solutions, along with setting more frequent compliance caps for these fees. It's important, as we do that, to keep in mind that there are other competitor cards available now which do not, technically speaking, involve the payment of interchange fees. I'm talking about companion cards here. Nonetheless, they're supported by payments made to the issuer funded by merchant fees, so they will have to be in the mix as well. More broadly, all these things that I mention, interchange, transparency, surcharging, are interrelated, so there are potentially multiple paths to achieving an appropriate outcome, and these are things that need to be taken in a holistic way. So let me encourage those of you who are interested in this to engage with our staff and with the bank in the review process that's underway. Let me then turn, before I finish, away from the Financial System Inquiry and its recommendations per se to a couple of other matters that I think are worthy of note. I said at the beginning that the search for yield continues. Now, there's a line of discussion that tackles this issue from a cyclical point of view. It thinks about how the balance sheet measures taken by the major central banks are affecting markets, what the extent is of cross-border spillovers, and so on. What will happen when the Fed starts to raise rates and all of that. And they're important questions. I've spoken about those matters in the past, and I don't want to revisit those today. There is another conversation, though, and this one takes place at a lower volume, but it's one that definitely needs to be had, that arises from the search for yield. And that conversation is about what all this means for the retirement income system over the period, over the years ahead. The question is, how will an adequate flow of income be generated for the retired community in the future in a world in which long-term nominal returns on low-risk assets are so low, incredibly low? If you want to lend to the government of Germany, you pay them for a term of up to 7 years. So it's a global question. Everywhere in the world, the price of buying a given annual flow of future income has gone up a lot. People who are seeking to make that purchase today, that is people who are about to leave the workforce, are in a much worse position making that purchase than people were 10 years ago. They have to accept a lot more risk to generate the expected flow of future income that they want. That problem must be acute in Europe, as I've said, where sovereign yields for some countries are negative for significant term. But it's also potentially a non-trivial question in our own country in the future. So in a conference about wealth like this one, I'd suggest that might be a topic worthy of discussion over the next couple of days. And then the final issue to touch on is conduct, or rather misconduct. This has loomed larger for longer in many jurisdictions than we would have thought likely a few years ago. Investigations and prosecutions for alleged past misconduct are ongoing, and it seems in some respects our own country has not been entirely immune from some of this. Now, without wanting in any way to pass judgment on any of those particular cases, the root causes seem to include distorted incentives and an erosion of a culture that placed great store on acting in a trustworthy way. Finance depends on trust. Ultimately, actually, it can depend on little else. And where trust has been damaged, repair has to be made. Accordingly, both the industry and the official community around the world are working hard at clarifying expected standards of behaviour. Various codes of practice are being developed. Calculation methodologies for benchmarks and so on are being refined, etc. In some cases, regulation is being contemplated. Initiatives like the Banking and Finance Oath, which is a private initiative in Australia, can, I think, make a very worthwhile contribution here if enough people are prepared to sign up and exhibit the promised behaviour. It'd be good to see more people sign up to that oath, actually. In the end, though, you can't legislate or regulate for culture or character. Culture has to be nurtured, and that's not a costless exercise. Character has to be developed, and it has to be exemplified in behaviour. And for all of us, all of you, all of us in the financial services and the official sectors, that's a never-ending task. With those few remarks, I wish you a successful conference, and I'd be happy to attempt your questions. Thank you very much.
Jacob Graeber from the Financial Review.
Thanks. Just a quick question before the inevitable one about monetary policy, which I'm contractually obliged to ask you. The issue you mentioned about the impact on retirees today with this extremely low yield world, what do you see as the role for monetary policy in that sort of a world, given that the impact of, say, cutting rates now hurts people in those positions far more than perhaps it benefits people who are borrowing?
Well, it's a consideration, and I've talked about those issues in other places at other times. But in a global setting, this is a much bigger issue than just Australia. And the fact is that for a whole host of reasons, one of which would be central bank actions, but another would be the behaviour of investors themselves, these long yields are incredibly low. Not just the lowest in living memory, but in all likelihood the lowest ever in human history, so far as we can tell. And I think, to me, this is a looming issue for the longer run. I think insurance companies, pension funds must find this a very difficult environment in which to meet the obligations that they have. Ultimately, what will be important is the real capital of economies, how productive and what are the earnings on that. And at present, I would say that those earnings are probably pretty reasonable right now, notwithstanding the reluctance of corporations to invest in many places in the world, including here. So the hope would be that the real productive capital stock of the economy can still generate adequate earnings, and ultimately that the financial rates of return we see will one day again bear a more normal relationship to that real set of capital earnings. But it'll be quite an adjustment to get back to that world, and it seems to be quite slow in coming. And in the interim, we have this phenomenon where in the financial space, increasing amount of risk is being taken, and it's important people realise how much risk is being taken there and are appraised of it. Meanwhile, our real economy risk-taking, so-called, is a little bit on the subdued side. So that's something of a conundrum that we hope might eventually be resolved. But I think that will take time. Do you want to ask your contractually obliged one? And I'll give you no comment now. How's that? We'll save you the trouble.
Let me tempt you anyway. The iron ore price is back up again. The dollar's firming. And those unemployment numbers looked quite healthy. Is there a shift in your thinking happening there at all?
You'll find out in due course.
Nice try, Jacob. Are there any further questions? We have this one from a gentleman just on the aisle here.
David Cox from Challenger Limited. Governor Stevens, you said that one of the objectives of a better regime for resolution of systemic banks' failure was to avoid taxpayers' dollars being unduly involved. The Murray Inquiry has suggested that there'd be no ex-ante fee on the financial claims scheme, but has also noted that the cap for the financial claims scheme is relatively high by international standards. I think only the US has a similar one. Do you think that an alternative, or would you like to comment on whether an alternative regime might be an ex-ante fee and a lower cap?
Well, it's no secret that I personally have tended to be in favour of the ex-ante fee for the simple reason that I think there's a logic for the government charging for insurance that it's clearly providing. The inquiry didn't agree with that. They came to the view that ex-post funding, if funding's needed, for the FCS is perfectly adequate, and I accept that conclusion that they've drawn. As for the size of the cap, it's at the generous end, that is true. I think it's probably not realistic to think that we're going to get it down. I mean, it was $1 million at one point, and before that it was unlimited. So we've managed to contain that back to something that's at least in the international ballpark. Strikes me as unlikely that we're going to credibly be able to lower that. But I think the big issues about resolution transcend the size of the deposit guarantee. They're much more difficult issues surrounding how you allocate losses in the event that a large entity of systemic importance gets into sufficient trouble that it's in doubt. And I think having a deposit insurance arrangement is a helpful stabilising device in that setting, but the questions are much bigger than just the deposit insurance.
There's just time for one more question. Jennifer Hewitt, I think, or is that Sally? Jennifer Hewitt from the Financial Review.
Hi. You talked, said that you didn't want to talk about monetary policy, understandably, but you did say that you thought there was too much weight put on monetary policy to get sustainable increases in growth. What else should the government and business be doing to get that growth going? And why do you think businesses globally remain so reluctant to invest? And can you see that ending anytime soon?
Well, the comment that too much weight's been put on monetary policy was a global one. I think that's just obvious that central banks around the world in many jurisdictions have found themselves in the position of almost the only actor able to act because political processes were gridlocked or fiscal positions were already sufficiently parlous that people didn't think that there was room for fiscal expansion. Supply-side reforms are always good, but they're very difficult to do politically, as we know. And so central banks have found themselves in this position of feeling, I think, what they can do is only of limited benefit, but they have to try to do what they can, and so they have. And the calculation they have to do is doing what you can, helpful without running too many other risks associated with some of the measures you might take. That's a calculation that we always have to carry out. What more could governments do? Well, I think to the extent that what people are most uncertain about in our own country or elsewhere is what's their future income, what are their future income prospects, the more any government could do to make those prospects look more positive and increase confidence in those prospects, the better. And if they could do that, that actually would give easy money more traction than it's presently getting. Now, how can governments do that? That's the big question. And this does, I think, bring us back to productivity. It's kind of a, you know, it's a boring lament in a way, but future income, that comes from productivity and efficiency. And we know that competitive markets, support for innovation, genuine entrepreneurialism, all those things other things that do most for our future income prospects for any given terms of trade story that we might have. So I think the focus comes back there. Those are hard things to do. But really, that's, I think, where the discussion needs to be. And if you can create a positive narrative there and people do feel more confident about future income, then we'll find that they're more inclined to spend today. And that's that will be done in a sustainable way. So that's, I guess, what I'd say about those matters.